Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to George Eaton and Stephen Bush about the fallout from the first all-Tory budget for nearly two decades. Then Barbara Speed and I look behind the curtain at Reddit, the website that produces most of the news you see in the newspapers. Now, yesterday, George Osborne stood up in the House of Commons facing a wall of noise and delivered the first Tory budget in nearly two decades. He was, he claimed, free from the shackles of the Lib Dems. But what did he offer? I'm joined by our politics editor George Eaton and Staggers editor Stephen Bush to discuss the fallout from a true blue budget. George, first of all, just give me the overnight reaction to this. The headline that's come out of it, obviously, is the living wage.
So there's been some pushback against it in that it's a living wage only on George Osborne's definition. The planned level of 720 for next year falls below the current voluntary living wage rate of 785, and that obviously excludes London. And the other key point that Labour and campaigners are making is that the current living wage rates take into account in-work benefits. They assume that support will be given to those in work, and of course George Osborne has made significant cuts to tax credits.
I was astonished to look at, I mean, the Daily Mail do a very, I don't know where they get their figures from. Even when I worked there, I never knew where they got their figures from. They would just sort of appear. I presume they come from the Red Book. The kind of how different families are affected, and it said, you know, high earning couple, you know, plus £200 a week, pensioner couple plus a couple hundred pounds, low income dual earner family with children losing £2,500 a year, and that to me, that's serious money that people are going to feel in their pockets. Is that really going to, you know, is that really going to continue that the narrative of this budget is going to be Osborne attacks the scourge of low pay?
Yes, I mean, I think that is the big question. Everyone's recognised yesterday's budget was very politically smart, and it, undoubtedly the living wage did give him some cover, and you can see how it took the wind out of Labour's sails as they tried to attack his cuts to tax credits. But yes, there are a lot of people who are going to be poorer as a result of the budget, who will not be compensate or anywhere anything close to it from the tax cuts, the rise in the personal allowance, and this new living wage. But whether that will harm the Tories significantly is an open question, because there was of course a lot of pain in the last parliament. People's tax credits were cut then. There was anger about austerity, but it didn't translate into a victory for Labour. And I think that's why you saw in her response yesterday, Harriet Harman doesn't want Labour just to appear a repository of protest, but to be a responsible opposition party. And that means they are going to oppose most of the cuts to tax credits, but they will support measures like the benefit cap, the budget surplus law, and the public sector 1% pay cap.
And Stephen, for the withdrawal of tax credits, the rationale is that, in fact, actually, by subsidising employers to be able to employ people on low wages, they've encouraged employers to get away with it, essentially. The idea that taking them away will some... What is the process by which, at that point, employers start paying better wages? Is it because they just simply can't get any staff? Is that the... And how long will that take to actually trickle through after people have experienced the cut in the tax cuts?
I suppose that, yeah, the theory is that you effectively create moral hazard with tax credits, that you are incentivizing employers to pay less than their employees need to live on. You would expect some businesses will make up the difference through wage rises, because they'll have to. If, say, you are a well-known electronic shop who needs, you know, people who are reasonably chirpy, happy, clean, not exhausted from long hours to sell your products, and you probably will make up the money. the people who will be really badly hit will be people who work for small businesses who genuinely can't find the extra headroom for the raises, or people who work in insecure work, so if they work in an Amazon factory, say.
Well, this is one of the things, and perhaps you can put me right here, one of you two, from a perspective of knowing slightly more about economics than I do, which is that when it was announced, you know, they might be trying to freeze in-work benefits for immigrants when they first come over, I thought, well, actually, isn't that a good thing? If you're essentially saying that tax credits are subsidising low wages, why would you subsidise low wages of non-citizens? Mm, is that madness, George?
I mean, I think is there an element of subsidy? Yes, there is, and undoubtedly some businesses do need a kick to pay more. But the tax credit system also exists for a reason, because wages cannot take account of differences in family size, for instance. They can't take account of whether you're a single earner or double earner, a couple. And so the tax credit system did significantly reduce child poverty in the New Labour years. I mean, that shouldn't be forgotten. And so it's not as simple as just moving from slashing tax credits and just having higher wages, not least because the higher wages, as we've seen, will not compensate for the losses experienced.
And one of the things that we were talking about yesterday, and I'm not sure whether or not it's become any clearer, is whether or not the living wage has any kind of geographical weighting in it. So we know already, I think, the median wage in the country is 26,000, 27,000, but in London it's 32,000, which takes account of the fact that businesses have to pay more because people can't, you know, simply things are much more expensive in London. Is there any kind of reflection of that in the living wage?
It doesn't look as if there will be. Of course, whether the London living wage is a course that the Conservative mayoral candidate will take up is a good question. I mean, there's an argument for devolving power over that to London. That may be something that George Osborne is thinking about, because I would be surprised if they don't address that anomaly at all, that they've said the living wage will be £9 by the end of the Parliament. That's lower than the current voluntary living wage rate in London, which is £9.15.
And Stephen, I want to ask about this idea that's come up overnight of kind of stealing Labour's best ideas, plundering, cross-dressing, all this sort of business. There's a bit of pre-distribution in there, isn't there? And also a little bit of, there was the kick for the, relatively small kick for non-doms. There was a kick for buy-to-let landlords. You know, how viscerally Tory a budget was this, really?
Yeah, so there were a lot of kind of Miliband notes that you've just mentioned, but no, the core of the budget was wholly Conservative. I mean, I think to me, not the worst in terms of how people will feel it, because ultimately people only pay it back when they are earning, you know, more than average income, was the conversion of maintenance grants to loans.
So this is student
loans
on low incomes. Yeah.
So instead of being, you get a top up of extra maintenance money if you're from a lower income background, but it's now a loan, not a grant, which effectively means that graduates from poorer backgrounds will have more debt to pay back up than their richer peers. Which, I mean, is equivalent to saying, oh, well, once you're earning the 40p rate, if your parents were unemployed or were paying basic rate or were below the threshold, we'll just add an extra penny on there because reasons. I mean, I think that felt to me like the most viscerally Conservative part of it, as well as, of course, the further cuts to ESA.
I was surprised that there was such a massive cheer for the commitment to 2% NATO defence spending. I mean, that really, they were so excited about it. They were waving their little papers around and bellowing. And I just thought, I get that people really like to stand on like a, you know, a big aircraft carrier and look macho, but it just, I find that slightly baffling. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, George, in a continuing series of George convinces me of socialist ideas, is there a downside to this idea that people in social housing who earn over £30,000 or £40,000 in London should pay market rents for living in that housing?
Mm. Well, I think the case that can be made against it is that social housing was designed to create inclusive communities, and it's encouraging the idea that it's social housing is just there for the very poorest and the most vulnerable. And also, and those figures are household income, so actually they're not huge salaries, and so I think by one definition those in London actually are earning just enough to get by.
I think one of the things that I find fascinating is if you look at, I mean, there's already been a lot of discussion anyway about how developers get around the, you know, having to provide a certain amount of social housing within developments, often by sort of giving councils just money for something else somewhere else or whatever. But also, what actually counts as an affordable rent? I mean, we're in the borough of Islington, I think, just technically here, just by the city. And when you look at, you know, even a rent, so a social housing rent is set at, what, 20% of market rate, and an affordable rent is much higher, up something like 40%. And the market rent is crazy. So what you end up with is a huge gulf between so-called affordable housing and social housing, and it's very difficult to get people to move between the two. I mean, is there anything that can be done about that, Stephen, apart from bringing market rents down by, you know, having more housing?
Not really. It is a supply-side problem. We have a long-term problem in this country that housing is treated as an asset class, not somewhere where people live. In the long term, it would be better, actually, if the cost of housing went down, A, through building, and B, through changing how we treat housing as an asset class. But, of course, politicians don't live in the long term. Osborne is a profoundly short-termist chancellor. You know, the interesting thing, lost amidst all the noise, was he's pushed back his target to eliminate the deficit again. Yeah, you know, he is now falling, you know, far short of the Darling plan, far short of the Balls plan. And, you know, the terrifying possibility is we'll be back here in 2020 saying that Sajid Javid is falling far short of the Chris Leslie deficit reduction plan.
Well, that's a lovely note to think of. Everyone likes a bit of Groundhog Day, which I have to say I felt as I saw Harriet Harman again standing up and it's doing another answer because you know, there's no leader. I wanted to ask, to finish, both of you, George first, was there anything that you liked in the budget?
Yes, I thought the best thing in the budget was the apprenticeship levy on large firms. I mean, it's a long overdue measure. And it's
so what exactly does it involve?
So it means that firms will have to fund apprenticeships themselves rather than the government picking up the tab. And of course, there are long-term benefits to companies to doing this, but rather than the UK governments for decades have tried the voluntary approach of encouraging firms to provide more apprenticeships. Now they're going to be forced to do so, and that's a good thing. That will help to raise productivity.
What's the stick that they're using to make firms do this? Because presumably you say that, you know, why wouldn't you just as a business just cut your apprenticeship scheme altogether?
Yeah, well, Osborne was quite smart in that he combined some quite interventionist moves like the apprenticeship levy with sweeteners elsewhere. So
corporation tax
is going to be reduced from 20%, which is already the joint lowest level in the G20, to 19% next year, and to just 18% the following year. So, you know, every you know, he did take with one hand but give with another,
which
so
he did with housing as well, I guess, by doing the sort of changes to the mortgage relief for buy-to-let loans, but at the same time saying, but I understand that, you know, people will be able to pass on property to that and the inheritance tax, and he framed those two as the sort of opposite sides of the same coin, I guess. And Stephen, what about you? What made you look at George Osborne and think, yes?
I mean, I like the apprenticeship, but I also actually liked the 2% defence target. To be honest, partly because, you know, there are a lot of manufacturing jobs which are going to be lost in this country over the next decade. It's quite nice to ring-fence some of them. I also think there is a strong argument to be made for keeping our international obligations. We are a member of NATO. We're also a signatory to the various development goals, which is why I think we should stick to our 0.7% aid target and our 2% defence target. It's political insulation for the aid target as well. And, you know, it's very easy to characterise everything the MOD does as going abroad and shooting people. It is also, you know, building resilience. It's also, you know,
training
police forces. Yeah. There are lots of positive things that the MOD does abroad. So, yeah, I quite liked that.
But that's interesting. So maybe that is really the story of the budget, is that kind of the new approach of twinning things. So of always finding a kind of equal and opposite policy so you can say, oh, yes, I've done this, but we've also done this. And I don't think, I can't remember a Gordon Brown budget that did that quite so successfully, although I'm sure there are many things that he gave with one hand and took with the other. But for the moment, thank you very much, George and Stephen. Reddit is one of the most popular and one of the most controversial sites on the internet. It functions as an aggregator where users can post links or photos that they found interesting and other users upvote them. The most upvoted ones end up on the front page, And that front page can drive an enormous amount of traffic. So, unsurprisingly, news websites often enjoy getting stuff on Reddit. They also enjoy nicking stuff off Reddit. But there is a problem in the Reddit ranks, and that's why I'm joined by our tech writer, Barbara Speed. So first of all, tell me what the latest Reddit kerfuffle is, and then perhaps we can go in a bit more into a history of previous Reddit kerfuffles.
So the latest kerfuffle in the nature of Reddit is slightly hard to understand, but essentially quite a popular Reddit employee named Victoria Taylor she left the site a few days ago under faintly mysterious circumstances. Reddit users and the team of people who kind of moderate the different sections of Reddit, who are kind of volunteers rather than direct employees, are really angry that she's gone. And they basically suspect that management has pushed her out for whatever reason. And the reason this is such a problem is that Reddit operates on these two levels, where you have Reddit HQ and then you have all the people who use and also the people who kind of run Reddit on an everyday kind of level.
And so for anybody who doesn't perhaps get the importance of Reddit, I think there was a brilliant piece, I'm going to say on The All, but I'm not sure if I'm entirely right, talking actually particularly about the early days of BuzzFeed. I think, you know, BuzzFeed has changed enormously in the last couple of years, and now obviously employs a huge number of journalists. But in its very early days, it did rely very heavily on finding content, that user-generated content on Reddit, and kind of repurposing it and packaging it. So you found, you know, lots of people who posted something as like, oh, you only had one job, you know, a thing that they, you know, shaved someone's head slightly wrongly or painted the lines on a road wrongly and collated them all, you know, into a post where it was like 21 times where somebody who only had one job messed up. And that was a kind of, that was when people kind of really began to cotton on to how much news organizations were using Reddit to kind of find quirky original stories. And
cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Lots of things that, you know, went viral had started off on Reddit. I mean, some of that is totally, obviously, totally legitimate. You find stories anywhere as a journalist, and it's about how much work you put into them, and that really makes a difference. But can you give me an idea of how important Reddit is to the news business?
I think it's incredibly important in a slightly odd way, in that it's not, people aren't breaking stories on Reddit, so they're not finding big news. They're not saying Syria has been invaded on Reddit. But it's those kind of weird little stories where if you thought about it, you'd be thinking, how did this news organization find out about this girl's birthday party where something insane happened, or this crazy cake that looked really silly?
You're talking about the frozen cake, aren't you?
I am talking about the frozen cake.
So there was a case where someone had posted a picture of a cake that was supposed to be Elsa from Frozen, but it was... her eyes were a bit far apart, I think, is the kindest thing that I can say about it. But then it turned out to be baked by like an adorable woman who'd baked it for her local cancer care charity or something. And she was like, I know it's not very good, but I'm not very good at baking. I just wanted to make some money.
And this ties into exactly the problem with Reddit, because on Reddit, you're a random person posting anonymously, and someone, I think the post said something like, what you expect your cake to look like and then what it actually looks like. And news organizations pick this up as read. They believe the fact that the first cake was meant to be made by the same person as the second cake, and when that wasn't true at all. And so they just published all these stories about it, and this poor woman who made this cake was like... And even,
that's one of my things that I find really interesting about, because Reddit relies very heavily on an image sharing service called Imgur, and things kind of get, you know, I mean, it's a sort of amazing place of gay copyright infringement abandon in some ways. You know, stuff just gets posted on there. But also... stuff gets stripped of its context and then repackaged with an obviously appealing context for news organisations. So that idea of, I'm sure that there were some people suggesting this was somebody who was a terrible swindler who ran a cake shop, who you went in and you thought you were going to buy an amazing cake and they delivered you some piece of ass, basically. And that's one of the things that I find really troublesome about it, is that there is a lot of it is taken at kind of face value by news organisations and not really checked. And that's particularly troublesome when you know that so many parts of the internet, you know, I'm thinking of somewhere like 4chan's B-board, you know, absolutely delight in, you know, winding up news organisations. I've just been reading Whitney Phillips's book, which is called This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, which is about internet trolling, but it's about internet trolling's relationship with the media. And it talks a little bit about, there was this craze that got reported in the New York Times. I can't remember what the name of it is. Horrible. It was the idea that there were slums in Africa that were so poor that people were reduced to getting high by sniffing fermented feces and urine that they put in a bottle. So this was one report in the New York Times. It was picked up by the BBC and sort of reported as, you know, in the New York Times this has been said. It then kind of went away for ages. And then after a couple of years, it was picked up by 4chaners who decided they were going to try and pretend that this was a thing that was happening in America, that American teenagers were all doing this because they'd read about it on the internet and like leaving it. And then they faked up photos of stuff and got people to write to school boards and pretend that this was sort of some massive menace. And it worked. And it was a sort of kind of like terrible things on Fox News of going like the menace of whatever this thing was called.
Fermented feces.
Yeah. And are your kids huffing feces? And the problem was that it was in what way we sort of in journalist circles always used to call too good to check, which was that it fitted into it. You know, young people always looking for something to get high off. You know, they're so they'll do anything. It had a gross out factor. It was brilliant. And that's what kind of internet trolls, subcultural trolls, you know, have always been brilliant at finding the stuff the media wants, finding the narrative the media wants. And that's one of the things that I find interesting about Reddit is that it's a source of, and it's a kind of meme factory. Mm. And it creates things that people want. But I'm going to stop boring you about trolls because there is another point here, which is that Reddit has not got a, how do I put this? Not got a brilliant history of its approach to anti-racism, anti-sexism, anti-Semitism, you know, all anti-Semitism, but all of those things. So Adrian Chen, who was then a reporter from Gawker, exposed a guy called Violent Acres, and that's to be called Michael Brutsch, who'd been a moderator on lots of its most grim threads. So there was like r/choker bitch and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And basically what had happened is exactly that point you were talking to, is there are two levels of Reddit. You know, there's actually, it's owned by a parent company that's related to Condé Nast, which owns a kind of lovely suite of, you know, brilliantly glossy magazines. Yeah. But there are also the moderators to whom the huge amount of work that goes into that site is outsourced to and for free, essentially. They do it because they really enjoy it. But in his case, he was moderating all the kind of horrible stuff. Actually, he probably had an industrial tribunal if you'd asked anybody to moderate as part of their job. So there is a problem. The sort of strike by moderators exposes one of the fundamental problems of Reddit, is that it relies on a huge amount of very valuable but unpaid labour, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the kind of catch-22 at the heart of all of this is that those people are motivated by the fact that they see it as this incredibly free, outspoken platform, and they're really kind of vigilante-esque about that. And obviously that is a good thing in some ways, but it has really negative downside. So as you were saying, certain subreddits, which they think they have every right to have, that this is the whole point of Reddit, that we can have fat people hate, we can have trans people hate. And the current interim CEO, this is another kind of revolt that happened a few weeks ago, shut down some of these particularly bad ones, and users responded very, very badly, and basically a load of them left the site. They've now started a petition calling for her to resign because she's shutting down free speech. She's censoring what was once this brilliant free speech platform. But it's really hard. You can see that it's hard to turn around and say, oh, well, you've done all this hard work, but we're going to shut you down.
But it's also quite a good reflection of that internet dictum, which is, you know, if you're, I think it was coined in regards to comment sections, but it employs with forums as well, which is like, if your site is full of dicks, it's your fault. Like, you have created the moment in which dicks will flourish.
They have created.
And that was the problem with the whole ethos of Reddit from the start, was about, you know, that it's a refuge from all these places where your speech is like so controlled and no one can tell you what to do. And there was similarly, but when they closed down all of Violent Acres' threats, so there was one that was upskirt pictures. And so obviously that's photos of women, sexualized photos of women taken without their consent. Some of them probably were probably underage by whatever place they were in. So they were probably technically child pornography. So from a business point of view, never mind an ethical point of view, that's an instant kind of, oh, I think I'm probably going to not let you post this kind of stuff on there. And actually 4chan, which is, you know, renowned as being, you know, the anarchic space that just anything goes, and people try to be deliberately as horrific as possible. Obviously it has an absolute ban on child pornography. And now Gamergate. actually, Moot, the founder, was just like, I think he just sort of essentially said, you guys are really boring, can you please not? And so they went off and founded 8chan or Infinity Chan or whatever, that was their own version of it. But the kind of backlash against Ellen Pao has, I mean, it's interesting, it's a female moderator that people are kind of cross about, but that has had a very racialized misogynist aspect to it, hasn't it? The backlash?
Yeah, it has. And obviously, there are always going to be people who'll say the very worst thing. So it's hard to kind of measure all the users' opinions on that basis. But the petition actually calling for her to leave, which has been signed by over 200,000 people, is in kind of in its subtext, is incredibly sexist. Like within the first few lines, it's obviously talking about this very specific incident. And then it says Ellen Powell failed in a sexual harassment case against her previous company. This shows that she's willing to sue her way to the top. She's this kind of woman who's coming in and trying to ruin this really open space that we've had, and her previous actions prove this. But the idea, and it's really depressing that you kind of think, do all these people genuinely think that the internet should be some brilliant place where you can be a sexist, and that if someone comes in and tries to change that, they're ruining everything about your site and you just have to get her to leave? Like, it's a bit depressing that this is clearly what quite a lot of the users think.
How do you think it will play out?
It's hard to say. I mean, she is only a sort of interim CEO, and she was never going to stay forever. I don't know. I assume that they won't kind of cave to what these people are asking for, personally, because that would just be really depressing. And she's apologized. She said that the kind of main administration has failed in its communication with all those volunteers, and they're obviously trying to get those people back on board by having like a sort of interim person who works between the two levels and is and almost like a union rep, really.
But I think that's really interesting, because for a lot of time before she was appointed, the way that it worked was very much that Reddit tried to pretend that there was no company behind it. It tried to make that completely invisible.
Yeah, exactly.
So you kind of every so often I would have a jolt and remember that, like, this thing that I was writing about or reading about that was posting this, like, some of the worst stuff I've seen on the internet, was actually owned by like a proper incorporated company with offices and
a media company, no less,
and
yeah.
You know, and presumably like a coffee machine and stuff like that. Because it was very much, I mean, 4chan is, as far as I know, just like is not commercialized in any sort of sense. But the other thing that was fascinating was the fact that, you know, Reddit is worth a huge amount, even if not necessarily in kind of market value, but in terms of the traffic it delivers to news sites. I mean, you know, we've seen it here that if you get something on the front page of Reddit, then, you know, nail down your server because it's going to get pretty hot. It's astonishing in how its importance in the news landscape, and yet it doesn't, it sort of flies totally below the radar.
But yeah, I mean, this was something that was kind of at the heart of the most recent problem, because one thing that people were saying was that Victoria Taylor had resisted Reddit's attempts to commercialize the section that she looked after, which is called Ask Me Anything, which is one of the site's most popular and kind of most mainstream sections, in that it has President Obama being asked questions by Reddit users, and it's sort of the nice side of Reddit, really, and it has this kind of great internet openness, and it's also interacting with the real world, and people are verified so that you know who you're talking to. And so, yeah, there was a suggestion that the administration was trying to kind of get money out of this section's popularity, and that she didn't like this. So the way that the other moderators kind of rallied behind her is quite interesting.
But that's not unreasonable, is it? If Reddit as a company, this is what I mean about kind of hiding the kind of corporate structure of it, because if you're an unpaid moderator, I'm sure many of these people are spending 20 hours a week moderating it. And some of that you do for the love. But at some point you think people must turn around and go, well, hang on a minute, someone's making a huge amount of money in this and I'm not getting anything. It's very hard to run that kind of communitarian ethos when somebody is, I mean, Wikipedia has its own problems with recruiting moderators and who the makeup of those moderators, but at least it's got a very clear top to bottom ethos that nobody's making a huge amount of money out of it. Everybody's doing it because they believe that it is a sort of a utopian project. It's harder to make that case with regards to Reddit, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's why I think the company's next moves will be really interesting, because obviously what they want to do next is to turn this into more of a viable business, to make it, because it's silly really to let this like huge amount of kind of momentum go to waste, but they need to do it in such a way that they're not alienating. I mean, the FT I think did quite an interesting graphic just kind of asking that question, like, how does Reddit carry on without alienating its core users? Because really, I mean, again, if it wants to grow that user base, it needs to grow beyond the people that think that sexism on the internet is great. It needs to not be scary and not be quite as unregulated as it is at the moment.
Well, it won't be able to get display advertising or native advertising because advertisers are incredibly sketchy and nervous about what they'll put their ads next to. I mean, I've read of a couple of companies that won't put their ads next to the Rihanna video, for example, and that's And that happens, you know, that happens a huge amount. It's one of the things that I think as a news organisation is something we don't talk about enough, is actually how much of the general landscape is shaped by what people will put their ads next to and what kind of content they prefer to be seen next to. And because we all rely on advertising money to sustain ourselves, what that pressure is, it drives us in. But in the case of Reddit, I think it probably drives it in quite a good direction, because people go, actually, you know, I don't want to be on like advertising my nice, I don't know, picnic hampers on r/rape that ass or whatever. Yeah. And that is going to become a hard decision. You know, does the company pick advertisers over users? And the users that probably, you know, are on those subreddits are the most vocal, because they feel, in this weird way, they feel marginalised. They feel that there's nowhere else on the internet where you can just sit around and be a massive racist.
Yeah.
Which they think is, you know, is just oppression. Actually, they're not really racist. They're just doing it to make a point that there should be a place where people are allowed to be racist. I think that's the rationale behind it often.
Yeah, and, well, you can almost see a situation where they do try and take some of those big mainstream subreddits and they advertise there, or they try and then there's still this sort of hinterland in the kind of back end of the site where all these people can operate. But then again, I mean, Ellen Powell said to the New York Times just that she can see that these people are a minority in the end. Like, obviously 200,000 people want her sacked, but like almost 200 million people use the site every month. And I think that most of those people, A, didn't really know what was going on, B, just want to see what other people on the internet care about. I mean, there's an extent to which you can push back against your core users. Oh,
those 200,000 people, probably actually just 200 people who've signed up 1,000 times.
With 10 change.org accounts.
But
yeah, quite possibly. But so there is an extent to which pandering to them would be quite a dangerous thing to do, because what they're asking for is, I mean, like, borderline illegal, essentially, because you're still hosting all this stuff. I mean, Reddit.
Well, yeah, but they're under the illusion that it's a democracy, whereas it's not. It's a company that they're allowed, you know, and it's a space that they are allowed to be on. They don't have any. The company doesn't have to let them be on there, but it's functioned for so long as if that were the case, to avoid exactly this problem that I guess people have really lost sight of that. Anyway, I sense we'll probably kind of come back, as particularly as I'm reading a book about the internet, so I'll have lots more thoughts to share with you. But for the moment, Barbara, thank you very much. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskowitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.